welcome to this special SearchSecurity.com podcast. I'm Eric Parizeau. It's great to have you with us. This podcast is part of our compliance school, which you can visit at any time by going to SearchSecurity.com/compliance school. Today, we're going to play a little fact or fiction regarding what it takes to build upon an existing compliance infrastructure to meet new compliance demands. Joining me today is Trent Henry, senior analyst with research firm Burton Group. Thanks for being here with us, Trent.
Thank you, Eric.
Okay, Trent, let's explain to our listeners just how this works. I'll read several statements pertaining to compliance technologies and how to go about using legacy products and processes to meet new compliance goals. After I read each statement, you'll tell me if the statement should be answered with fact or fiction, and then explain why. So let's get started. Fact or fiction, my company has addressed all the major U.S. compliance mandates, and we've assembled an impressive combination of tools and infrastructure, so most of our compliance work is done.
Well, the sad news there is that it's basically fiction. So it turns out that we are several years beyond the Sarbanes-Oxley Act in the United States, which, from my perspective, is arguably the most heavily invested compliance requirement we've ever seen. You know, we've billions and billions of dollars of expenditures, which has, you know, helped the compliance landscape for organizations. But there are a number of compliance issues that continue to plague organizations and are moving forward. For example, I'm talking to clients who have a number of deadlines for the payment card industry data security standard, so companies are scrambling to work with their assessors or their auditors and figure out what gaps they have in their infrastructure for handling credit card information. In Japan, their version of the Financial Disclosure Act, which is often called JSOX, is having an effect there that is rippling across the industry, much in the way that SOX did here in the United States and Europe before that. And so there are, I think, really a number of other mandates that are around the corner, and not the least of which is an expected federal law for breach disclosures in the United States. So we still have compliance work ahead. There is a key here, though. As you mentioned, a number of organizations have built out infrastructure, so where possible, we want them to reuse those technologies. Here's an example. If an enterprise improves its confidentiality and protection of customer data by deploying improved technology, what they need to do is evaluate when a new compliance mandate comes down the pike and it relates to customer data or other type of confidentiality and see whether their existing infrastructure helps to satisfy that compliance mandate rather than assume that additional investment is automatically required.
Okay, here's the next statement. Fact or fiction, organizations today are more worried about customer data than critical intellectual property, such as source code or manufacturing plans.
Well, yeah, you would definitely think that manufacturing plans would be the keys to the kingdom, but this is actually a fact. Most organizations I'm talking to are going after that low-hanging fruit, so sort of non-intuitive, but many of the dollars spent on that protection are really tied to customer privacy. A lot of that relates to these issues around the types of compliance laws that have been passed most recently. It's also the case that there really hasn't been a lot of economic incentive in the United States for organizations to do a great job protecting customer data. Really, it's been the responsibility of customers themselves, if there's a privacy breach, to clean up after the problem. So, and that was quite a bit different than what we saw in Europe. These new regulations are really trying to help catch up and basically replace some of this burden on companies that are collecting the data, so that when a breach occurs and there's the possibility of identity fraud, it's not just the consumer that's left hung out to dry. Now, having said that, even though this customer data protection is the low-hanging fruit that's motivating a lot of investment, I think smart enterprises should realize that many of the tools they're deploying for that sort of protection can also help with their really critical intellectual property. So privacy protection might help to bolster the budget or make the argument for additional funds, but tools should be selected with an eye to protecting all the critical sensitive information in the enterprise.
Trent, as you mentioned, many states have passed data breach disclosure laws, and enterprises have largely put measures in place to make sure they never have to face the bad PR that comes with a disclosure. In hindsight, has this fear, though, taken too much emphasis away from other compliance initiatives? Has it done more harm than good in that sense?
Well, so there was an interesting study recently that suggested the amount of identity fraud that occurs when there's a breach is actually quite small. On the one hand, the rampant media headlines about breach disclosure may overstate the amount of danger that we have, because a lot of identity fraud does not occur as a result of some lost credit card numbers or misplaced laptops with social security numbers. However, as I mentioned, there has been this economic disincentive for companies in America specifically to really adequately protect that customer data, so that when something bad does occur, the consumer really ends up getting hurt quite badly. So the one piece of good news is we're augmenting protection that we probably should have done as individual enterprises long ago. So I think my ultimate opinion is that these laws haven't gone too far, and they are helping to buttress prudent protection in enterprises.
All right, here's the next statement. Fact or fiction, auditors are a good resource for determining how to tackle compliance requirements.
Yeah, this is very much a fact. And, you know, I think a number of organizations don't really realize that. They're concerned that there's a bit of a conflict of interest, you know, separation of church and state between the audit side of the house and the security or the IT side of the house. You know, I've also heard a number of enterprises talking about auditors with throwing rocks in IT glass houses and then running away. So there's not always been the best relationship. But it really turns out that these folks that are helping us to assess controls can also be very informative about the requirements. So what we like to say at Burton Group is that the auditors are our friends, not our foes. And even, you know, at the federal government level, where Sarbanes-Oxley had, you know, had some pretty significant separations between what the auditor role is and what the enterprise role is, those regulators have come back to say, you know, guys, we really need to open up the lines of communication so that you're working more closely together. Now, there are a number of security teams that I've talked to that have created relatively strong ties to their audit team, and that helps them determine what are the compliance requirements, what are the types of controls that need to be deployed, and how do we actually show evidence that the technologies that we're choosing are effectively operating in our environment. So they can't come in and help you design the solution, but they can certainly help you with requirements, controls, adequacy, and understanding how to demonstrate that things are operating in a compliant way.
Okay, Trent, we've reached the halfway point, so let's keep going. Fact or fiction, when it comes to compliance, the perimeter is dead. Deperimeterization is the new reality in security architecture.
I have a number of colleagues that might disagree with me, but I think this is a fiction. So it turns out there's a group called the Jericho Forum. A number of enterprises are members and are working on this effort. And, you know, in keeping with this idea of Jericho, they're talking about the walls coming down. And here's what their argument is, and it's relatively convincing. What they're saying is that the hard, crunchy firewall perimeter and the soft, chewy, unprotected interior that we've traditionally had in enterprises is a failing solution. These exterior firewalls are increasingly lax in their policies. There's lots of holes punched through, you know, Swiss cheese for all kinds of different applications and business partner connections. And there's a huge amount of traffic that flows over our web channels anyway, so traffic-based controls are somewhat ineffective. So, and finally, that there's a large number of machines that are really mobile, so they're not within our typical enterprise perimeter anyway. They're connecting to the network all over the place. So their ultimate argument is traditional perimeters really are meaningless. My feeling is that it is true that these are some real trends within the modern enterprise, and the result is that there is tighter and deeper protection, specifically within content itself and around endpoints, that's taking place. So there is truth in this trend. However, I don't think that firewalls or a strong perimeter defense is going away by any stretch of the imagination. We have a number of attacks, be it the availability of information, denial of service attacks, just policy enforcement about what types of users are allowed to connect to what types of systems. It's not incredibly granular, but those are still important first lines of defense. And there are also elements of the perimeter, like intrusion detection systems, that not only help us validate the policies on the perimeter, they're explicitly mandated in some of the compliance requirements, like the payment card industry data security standard. So I think it's certainly a fiction that the perimeter is dead.
All right, Trent, here's another one. Fact or fiction, deploying even more software will help reuse of existing technology for compliance.
Yeah, this is a fact, and it's another thing that folks are thinking about budgeting for, but I particularly think that some of the governance and risk and compliance software solutions, or what I often like to describe as security compliance orchestration tools, help us to get a handle on what are the main drivers for compliance in our environment, both technical and non-technical, and then help us with the process of collecting the evidence and assessing their effectiveness. The idea is that we have lots of technology deployed. It's each of those tries to manage their own silo. Each of them are often trying to tie back to compliance mandates, but they don't extend, you know, horizontally across the enterprise. So if your encryption solution is doing one thing and one of your auditing and monitoring solutions is doing something else, what you really need to do is evaluate how the two of those are working together to improve protection and be compliant. And you really need a higher level of software to help you with that process. So indeed, I think it's the fact that compliance orchestration is some software we should all be looking at.
Trent, to look at this from the CIO's perspective, if I'm a security pro and I need to go in and say I need new software to make the old software work, that doesn't seem like an easy sell to me. So even if that is the case, what's your advice when it's time to go into that budget meeting and make that pitch?
Yeah, I would agree. This is something that the CIO could easily scratch their head and say, wait a minute, didn't I already spend a bunch of money to become compliant? There's two things that I think help support the argument. Number one is some organizations have been focused on buying new technologies to get their compliance story in order. And what I think additional software, rather than control point solutions, what additional orchestration software helps us do is really to assess what our existing infrastructure can do for us and what gaps remain. So the first thing that it's really doing is helping us understand how far we can get with what we currently have. So in some ways, that can save us from buying a number of new compliance-related technologies. Number two are the inefficiencies with personnel involved in assessing all of this infrastructure and helping to make the argument with auditors that we really do comply. So I think information technology or an information security team spends the time to understand what they're spending on personnel to conduct audits, to gather evidence, they'll see that there's all kinds of process improvements that can take place. And we've, in the case of identity management, user provisioning, help desk expense, when we've tracked that, we see that provisioning solutions really do have a good ROI. And I think in terms of staff efficiencies, we can make a similar argument for compliance orchestration and compliance evidence gathering.
Okay, Trent, here's the last one. Fact or fiction, as a must-have technology, encryption is really the ultimate answer to compliance mandates for data protection.
Well, so this is one of those questions that I hate to say fiction to, but it is fiction. And so here's the factual part. The factual part is that many of the compliance mandates that we're struggling with are fundamentally about confidentiality, very much about customer information protection, and encryption can play an incredibly important role. The concern that I have is that many organizations think all they need to do is deploy a quick and easy silo of encryption, and then they're compliant with the vast majority of issues that they have facing them. And that really isn't the case. So on the one hand, we do still have a number of compliance mandates that aren't related to confidentiality, and Sarbanes-Oxley is, of course, the great example of that. In fact, I know one story of a client who, at the beginning of their SOX project, they had known for some time that they wanted to deploy an encryption solution, that it would help with a number of protection problems they had. So when SOX rolled down the pipe, they took their plan to the legal team. It turns out for this organization, the legal team was the approving body, and they said, hey, our response to SOX is this new encryption solution that will really help us. And the legal team just looked at them blankly and said, you know, Sarbanes-Oxley has no requirements for encryption. It's about the integrity of our financials. I'm sorry, we can't approve this. So the team turned around and dejectedly hung their heads and left the room. What we have to be mindful of is what are the real compliance requirements in our organization? And sometimes confidentiality isn't the primary driver. The other thing I also like to bring up is that encryption needs a strong supporting cast of other technologies, things like policies, things like user identification and authentication, the management of keys over time. And we also have to make some hard decisions about where encryption resides in the organization, whether it's in the laptop that prevents some of the theft of media concerns, or whether it's more in the application layer where we have tighter control over use of data. So from that perspective, there's no magic bullet, no special pill that encryption gives us. There's lots of careful consideration and thought, although it can play an important role.
All right, a lot of good things to think about. Trent Henry of Burton Group, thanks for spending some time with us today.
My pleasure.
For more materials in our Compliance School, visit searchsecurity.com/compliance school. And we have many more information security podcasts available for you on our podcast page at searchsecurity.com/podcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Eric Parizer. Stay safe out there.